You're listening to Sirens, a true crime podcast brought to you by the Sirens Network. This podcast contains explicit content, so listener discretion is advised. The opinions expressed on this podcast are solely the views of the hosts and do not reflect the views of affiliates, associates, or sponsors of this podcast. A break from our regular programming for this special episode. Raven's Reviews.
Hey.
Hello. Hi.
How are you?
How are you?
Good. Feeding my face while I was waiting.
Hey.
Nice to meet you guys.
I'm Raven. This is Mandy.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, oh, thanks for you. Being with us.
You read the book.
I did. Yeah, I got it. I gave it to Mandy to read real quick.
Great. I was perusing your page earlier, but yeah, your book looks really interesting. Your Sins of the Self looks really interesting.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that's three cases we worked here in Oklahoma. We just kind of had to... I did my PI stuff, but I never got licensed. I didn't actually work with it because the second that I did my training with it, I started a podcast. And so when these three cases came along, we kind of had to go in and use that skill to kind of, because they're all cold and no one has any information about anything ever. So no. I know you know how that goes, but... Yeah, so it's our investigation of those three cases so far anyway.
What are, in Oklahoma, what are the state laws? Do you have to take a course or do you have to be?
Actually in Oklahoma, so there are courses here and you can do any kind of course, but then they want you to do CLEAT certification, which here is it's law enforcement certification.
Oh.
So they want you to actually take CLEAT 1 and 3, which is unarmed security guard and then private investigation.
So, but the course is you don't actually have to be employed, right? As those. Oh, okay.
No, I mean, if you as long as you're not working with the public, you can just take the coursework you don't actually have to get your licensure. But here, if you're working as an employed private investigator, somebody paying you, then they want you to have that license.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. It's a little different
each state's
here.
Different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Each state's different. I just work under someone else's license.
Yeah.
I have free.
Yeah. And then right next door, Arkansas, I don't even think you have to have any kind of training whatsoever.
Isn't that weird? Yeah. Some of them don't require anything. I know there's a few states that don't require anything.
Yeah. It's so strange. It's really strange. But I read in your book, and this is something I would not be... I don't have the courage to do is bounty hunting.
Yeah.
That's
not for everybody.
It's wild. Some of the stories that you put in your book, which by the way is called The Hunt for Brianna Maitland, The Relentless Pursuit of Answers to One of Vermont's Biggest Questions, as told by the family's private investigator, Greg Overacker, which is whom we are talking to right now. So tell us a little bit about your bounty hunting days.
So I started doing that when I was pretty young. I was in my mid-20s, and it was an adventure thing. You know, I wanted an adventure kind of thing. And I ended up traveling up and down the East Coast, and I worked for a guy. I met a guy in New Jersey named Scott Churchill, who I went to work for. And I would go down there and spend, a couple weeks at a time, or I would just go down through. Normally how that job functions is being in upstate New York, I would advertise nationwide and I would get 1-4% of my advertisements returns. And, people from other areas would contact me to bring their skips back to where they are.
Mm, yeah.
So, they would call me from the Carolinas or wherever, Florida, wherever. And I would pick the person up here and take them down there. In other words, they don't want to come up here and have to look around and do the work. Pick them up and then bring them back. I mean, if they sent me somewhere and let's say they sent me, farther upstate or into Pennsylvania or something like that, and I couldn't come up with a person, we'd go from there. So that's kind of how that functions. So I traveled a lot, and which was fun at the time, but, that gets old after a while. And then I got married for a very brief time, but I kind of stopped doing it mostly when that happened in 2000. And then my old clients would call me after that, after the marriage ended, and I would work for them. So, but it was interesting. It's not something that is for everybody. It's not something I would have wanted to do forever.
Yeah, you said in your book you got shot at, which is...
There's some interesting stories in there. And, you know, I don't know, looking back, being an older guy now, I don't know if I was stupid or crazy or wanted adventure, but it can maybe a combination of everything. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. The people seem to gravitate to that in the book. They like that part of the book, which I didn't want to put anything in there, but... So what I did was, I've never written a book before. When I wrote it, I gave it to a test audience of about a dozen people, family and friends. And they shared it with a few people. But that was kind of an optional part of the book. Should this be in here? And they said it has to be. Everyone said it has to be. People are going to know who you are, why you wrote it, what your background is.
Yeah, exactly.
So it worked out well.
Yeah.
So that worked out well, and everybody seemed to really enjoy it, too. And as a matter of fact, my publisher said, you need to just write a book just about that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm really interested in that. See, writing something.
That's one thing that we've been told, like with our book, that's another thing that we were told several times. Like, leave yourself completely out of it. Don't put anything about yourself in there. And we actually did leave a lot about ourselves. So we're working on another one where we're throwing all that back in because we also think that it's important for people to know why you're doing this.
Yeah. And I think in this book about Brianna, it had to be the whole reason that the book exists is because it's my experience with her case. So it didn't make any sense if I wasn't in it, I guess.
Yeah.
So I had to briefly put something, which I talked about that I didn't really want to distract from the story, but it wouldn't make any sense if I didn't put that in there. But yeah, you definitely should. People want to know who you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed those parts.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think I do I gravitate to the books where people kind of ingrain themselves in it. Like, I mean, if you look at the most popular ones, Chase Darkness with Me, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, Unmasked, Hell in the Heartland, you have the person telling this story and sharing their experiences.
Well, they're talking to you, not at you.
Right.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's that thing, too. And I didn't do it. I didn't knowingly do this. But you know that saying, choose an endeavor so big that when you're done, it's changed you as a person kind of thing. I don't know exactly how the saying goes, but. And that's what's happened. The book was written completely from my information. You know, I never understood you would hear like musicians and stuff saying that they didn't want their stuff stolen. No one else could write that. No one else could produce what they produced. And when you steal it, you're robbing something that was one of a kind and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yeah. But then when my book came out and people would say, I'd see in the comments, they'd say, I read this book, I really loved it, and I gave it to the public library. And I'm like, that's fine. I support all libraries. But don't give my shit away for free.
You know? That's funny.
You know what I mean?
It's because, yeah, we feel you. We know exactly what you mean.
You know, and I gave my time to this for 18 years right now, thousands of hours, and just expenses. I can't even begin to tell you how many nights I've spent in Vermont, all that other stuff, and the records I've kept and the time I've spent on it. Every day I'm on the phone or talking to somebody or whatever. And I produced a book out of my own pocket, which is fine. I wanted to do all that stuff. It was by choice. Buying the book supports me. And I think that's important too.
Right.
But I get that whole aspect of it now, you know, I going back to the whole thing that nobody else could have written that book is, you know, during the pandemic, I was extremely isolated. First of all, I was recovered from surgery when it started. And then, I mean, I don't even have a goldfish. So I was just here alone in my house, you know, for a long time. I couldn't work or anything like that because of the pandemic or whatever. But my brother said, now's the time to do this if you're going to do it. I had so many notes. I have a chest that's full of my notes. And I had them strewn out all around the house. It wasn't going to bother anybody. There's nobody else living here. So I could go through and I knew where everything was. I knew whatever I wanted and I could put it together well. So I always tell people when they're going to read it, keep in mind that it's not a book you're going to read where, you know, I explain that, you know, when you read a book and they dress it up as, you know, in Vermont and it's sugaring season, mm-hmm. this is in bloom and this is going on and mm-hmm. this town was built in 18, whatever.
Yeah.
And this book is just facts.
Yeah.
You're going to get facts. You're going to get the who, what, where, and when.
We did that a little bit. Yeah.
Curious about it. You're going to know when you're done with the book, you're going to know what the correct information is and everything else. The other thing I tell people is that there's two lengthy newspaper articles in it by Hank Albarelli, who was a journalist who lived in Vermont. Wonderful guys. He's since passed away. He and I became friends. And those make it a little repetitive. Plus, there's a timeline in it. But it's don't look at it that way. Look at it as you're learning the material. And in those articles, you can kind of see how with the as time goes on, how you find out that certain things are not correct. You know, mm-hmm. the more information you get to correct yourself and say, okay, now we have more information. This is actually what took place or whatever. So those are the two things I always tell people. The book's gotten really, thankfully, it's gotten extremely good reviews. I only sell it through my publisher, maybe 7 or 8 bookstores in Vermont, one in New York. And on Facebook, when people contact me, I send it to them directly and I sign them a copy. It's gotten great reviews. So, and a lot of people have contacted me from that area up in Vermont and have thanked me. I mean, I'm talking probably 80-100 people saying our community needed this and it was important to get this out there and dispel all the rumors and stuff. So mm-hmm. that made it really good that I did that.
Yeah, we actually know exactly what you mean because we have had that too, especially yeah. with the case in our book with the Ada case. It's just the smaller communities like that, they don't really know how to get the word out. They don't,
yeah.
you know, and they're so appreciative. And we've had tons of people come mm-hmm. to go and say, like, we didn't know that part of it. Like, we didn't know any right. of that was going on. And it's like, well, that's the whole reason why we do it is to kind of squash rumors and say, hey, you know, we know there's a rumor mill and here's the yeah. facts of it. Here's the facts of the matter.
That was one of the ones that looked really interesting to me when I was reading your website earlier. So that's so important. I think it helps people process that
yeah.
correctly. So that, you know, Brianna's disappearance up there was traumatizing to a lot of people and it hangs like a black cloud. I think one of the girls that contacted me and bought the book from me and a lot of the people went on their Facebook and they went on like Facebook for St. Albans and stuff like that. And they posted it and gave a review and other people bought it. But she wrote a really nice review and she said, as a young girl, the things that I heard about Brianna's disappearance in my mind as a child, it, you know, children don't know how to quite process this stuff correctly. She said, I felt like people were blaming her for her own disappearance,
yeah.
you mm-hmm. know, and that seems to be a big thing. Yep. Now, one thing that people forget about Brianna is that she was a kid.
Yep.
And they kind of treat her like she's an adult and saying, you know, she was doing the bad this and the bad that. Well, I don't care what she was doing. She was
yeah.
a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, she didn't yet have the ability to probably make good decisions, but,
she was a victim.
Yeah.
She's a victim. Right.
That's just like our Daniel Furr case. I mean, he was 15 and we got the exact stuff. Like we heard so much, well, it's his fault. He was a runaway before this and blah, blah, blah. And right. drugs and gangs. And it's like, well, we don't even really know.
And it doesn't matter. You know,
it doesn't matter.
Of course, that's yeah. my specialty yeah. is victimology because yeah. that's what I do mm-hmm. is victimology. And I wrote courses for college victimology and teach those. And so it doesn't matter what someone was doing.
Yeah.
It does not yeah. give anyone a right to assault them or hurt mm-mm. them. It does not matter.
No.
Right. I guess it's human nature. We have that thing of they got what they deserve kind of attitude a lot of times.
Well, it's easy to write people off that way. It's easy to...
Yeah.
to resolve that no one's going to solve this case by just going, well, they deserved it. So,
yeah. Yeah. You know, that's another thing. It's funny that you say that. So Maura Murray, the other disappearance mm-hmm. that's in the book that I talk mm-hmm. about. So mm-hmm. her and Brianna, because they went missing in a sparsely populated, you know, North Country areas and their cars were found by the side of the road and they were gone. they've always kind of been related in people's minds. Well, Maura's case got a lot of exposure and a lot of attention, whereas Brianna's not so much. And so people always wonder kind of why. Well, one of the reasons, and this was a pretty simple thing, was the police came out initially and said Brianna was involved in the drug community in her area.
It almost seems like they're real quick to, that's like the first thing that people want to say. Well, they were in drugs.
All kids are kind of doing the same thing. But so that, of course, the parents were outraged, and eventually they put a little retraction. But, you know, by then the damage is done.
Yeah.
Can't take that back. It doesn't matter what you do. Mm-hmm. So that, everybody psychologically, everybody flipped to, but the drug thing. And that's why it didn't get the exposure. So psychologically, consciously or unconsciously, that changed everybody's attitude towards Brianna. So I just thought that was horrible. And that was a big factor in that.
That's interesting to me, just because, you know, with Maura, you know, the alcohol was found in the car everywhere. And so that didn't, you know, that still didn't hurt that exposure. But yet something like that, where they said, oh, she was, you know, into the drug community, could automatically hurt that exposure. That's just, to me, is bizarre.
Yeah. Both of those disappearances are odd too. Yeah. But yeah, you're right.
You know, and one of the things that I was actually going to ask you about was, you know, with the Maura, you know, with Maura Murray and Marina, did Maura ever go to that same restaurant that Brianna worked at?
No, you know, if you looked at a map or you were familiar with the area, I know you guys aren't from anywhere near here, but they're quite a distance from each other. Okay. I mean, Maura came up from Massachusetts, and she drove, I think it was like 150 miles up to where she went missing. It's a really bizarre spot. But so that would leave her, the distance she was at her crash site to where Brianna's crash site was and where Brianna lived, was like, I think it was 80 to 90 miles. I'd have to look it up. It's in the book.
So a good hour.
Yeah, 90 miles.
It's quite a distance, because, and it's rural driving. It's not, you know, it's hill and dale kind of driving. And Maura had searched areas. There was some maps found and stuff like that. She, and on her computer stuff, she had searched areas. Now her family had vacationed often. I mean, their whole lives up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire and stuff like that. And I think she had a search in there for Burlington, Vermont, in Stowe. She'd inquired about Stowe. So it's all very all over the place. But
so I want to just give just a quick rundown on Brianna Maitland's case. And this is mostly, you cover so much in here in this book. I want you to see. Can you see my highlights? It's just like highlighted.
It's a lot to absorb, isn't it?
Yeah, I
like that, though. I could tell you're a reader.
She, you took the time. She highlights a lot.
I like to annotate.
And I read like she does, but I never highlight. And I guess it's because I teach college, and so I'm always having to highlight those
those
instructor books that I'm like, I'm out. When
but
it's
I'm
my
weird
own.
About it. I don't like the colored highlights. I literally use gray highlights. Anyway. So we're talking about Brianna Maitland, and this is a case from, we believe she went missing March 19th, 2004. I believe you say in here that Maura Murray went missing like 6 weeks prior to that.
So Maura was February 9th, 2004 in Haverhill, New Hampshire, which is right on the Vermont-New Hampshire border. And Brianna was March 19th, 2004 in Montgomery, Vermont.
There's some strange occurrences here. This is the weird thing, is like, I had heard about Maura Murray's case, but I had never actually like looked into it.
I have.
I know you have.
Yeah, I've done a lot of research on Maura Murray's case.
And we do know Julie, but we've still just, we've never like really deep dove into it. And so I didn't really know a bunch of things that occurred. And then, so I'm reading your book because I've heard of the Brianna Maitland case as well, but I've never really looked into it. I mean, we're really far away. We're in Oklahoma. So we mostly dive into,
I've read some stuff on it before.
I had never. And so then you got me asking like all these questions, and I'm like, okay, well now I need to look into Maura Murray's case. And now I need to go down this rabbit hole. And then I'm watching Disappeared that I know that you were on, you interviewed for. Yeah. And like all this stuff. But like they are very similar because it's so strange the way that they disappeared. It's like yeah. everything's totally fine. And then at least with Brianna, it's like she just leaves work and she vanishes forever.
You know, when you look at them at first glance, they look a lot similar because there's a car found on the side of the road and they're gone. In a heartbeat, they're gone. When you look deeper, they don't look very similar. Right. So
yeah,
in the book, I tried to do that comparison a bit. So there's two Disappeared episodes on Discovery ID, mm-hmm. one on Brianna, one on Maura. And that was a good show. As a matter of fact, I'm still really good friends with the producer of that show, Chris Cadez, that produced Brianna's episode. I don't remember if he did Maura's or not.
They did some Oklahoma cases too.
Yeah. It's a good show.
It was a nutshell. Yeah. So you're getting the basic story. I mean, but they did good for the time frame they had. And then, of course, Maura had the one on the Oxygen Channel mm-hmm. that was like six episodes mm-hmm. or something. This Maura Murray. So yeah. that was pretty good. I went to the live show. Tim and Lance from the Crawl Space podcast there. They did a live show in Boston at the Rockwell Theater. And Maggie Freeling and Art Roderick, who hosted that miniseries, docuseries, whatever it's called, they were there on stage and they answered questions and stuff like that. And afterwards, I went backstage and talked to them. And they said they would have done one on Brianna in a heartbeat. Those shows are really expensive. I mean, you have to have yeah. some kind of bat to do them.
Yeah.
I should let you go. Keep going because you had a thought there. But
I was just kind of running down the case just for those who don't really know exactly what happened, where the cars were found. And then and the strange things to me is you do put some stuff in here about how the car was found, how some people took some photos of it, how it was never processed by the police, how it was towed, yeah. but no one was ever told that it was towed. And it was a while before they even knew that Brianna was missing. And,
yeah.
you know, we've already lost that first 48, you know, in quotes, first yeah. 48.
For the sure. dad to go check the car.
Yeah. If they read this, they're going to get all the information that they need.
Yeah. We would hear people talk about that and they would have the basics kind of right. But this gives you like the day by day, minute by minute, what happened. Right. So you can know for sure what actually happened. And that was bizarre. You know, Brianna at the time, what had happened was Bruce and Kelly, her parents, were having problems in their marriage and stuff. And Bruce was actually had moved out of the house. They were going to share an apartment, him and Brianna, because Brianna wanted to be in town. If you're there in that area, it's hard to explain if you've never experienced it before, but it's very rural. And she wanted to be in town near her friends. And, you know, she was 17. She'd been given a car by her grandfather. Actually, Bruce was living at home at the time, but he was renting an apartment. I don't think he had made that move yet. But she was kind of going from friend to friend and sleeping on couches and just she wanted to be out and about with everybody and all that other stuff instead of up in this house that was their house sat up, had a mile long driveway back into the woods and they had water power, solar power and stuff like that, and heated with wood. And I think they had 60 acres. It was right on the Canadian border. Literally, that was their property line.
Wow.
Was the Canadian border. It's all wooded. You know, Vermont is 76%. Yeah, Vermont is 76% wooded. I mean, it's the boonies kind of thing. But she was staying with a friend, and she got up that day. Her friend went to school. She had left the girl a note and said, I'm going to work tonight, and I'll be out between 10 and midnight. She washed dishes at a historic inn. But she went with her mother that day. She got her GED results. She went shopping. Had lunch with her mother, did some clothing shopping. Mother bought her some clothes. Mother and her went back to the house. You know, mother dropped her off. She got changed and she took off to work. She got to work and she worked in this little inn. I mean, Montgomery is just a little tiny town. The inn is small itself. She parked right in a parking lot where she could look out the window and see her car. Not a ton of employees in there because it's such a small place. It was like a you know, it was a tiny bar. It was food. You could rent a room.
You know, that reminds me, it makes me think of the, was it, where were those women disappeared? I want to say it was Yosemite. Was it Yosemite? Where the mom and the two girls were at the inn.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and it was someone that worked there.
Oh.
It was Carrie Stainer.
Yes, Carrie Stainer. His brother was the one that disappeared, you know, and had come back years later.
Wow.
Was kidnapped. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Steven Stainer.
My name is Steven.
You know, another employee said everything seemed fine. She wasn't upset about anything or anything like that. When she left, she punched out at 11:20. They asked her if she wanted to stay and eat. I used to work at a restaurant. They would do that before you left. They'd say, do you want something to eat? They'd make you something. Or if there was a buffet, they'd eat off the buffet. But she said, no, I got to get up really early. She worked at a diner in the morning. She was just starting both jobs. She'd only work at the Lantern three nights.
Oh, wow.
In KJ's Diner in St. Albans, which isn't there anymore. I mean, the diner's there, but it's called something different. But so she left. I think she had to be to work at like 5:30 the next morning, so she had to get some rest. So she took off. Where her car was found was literally 2 minutes up the road. So she got in the car, pulled away, and right there is where you're kind of leaving town, and you can cruise out and get up to 50 miles an hour on this country highway, you know?
Yeah.
So she's 2 minutes up the road. They find her car backed into an abandoned old farmhouse. It had been abandoned for years. The windows were boarded up and stuff, and it sat near the road. But she had to cross oncoming traffic and then back up into this house. And she hit it fairly well, and the board from one of the windows fell, piece of plywood, onto the back of the vehicle and stuff. There's pictures of it in there. Over the course of the night, starting around midnight, a little earlier, people start seeing the vehicle. And so we have some witnesses in the overnight period. You know, people saying that the lights were on, doors were open. One of them said a blinker was on. In the morning, real early, like 8:30 or something like that, a car goes by with three young people in it. They're headed to Jay Peak. Jay Peak is a little resort ski area there nearby. So they were heading the opposite direction she was. They were going into town, and they see it. And they thought it was so strange. They pulled over and took pictures of it, and they opened the door. The doors were then shut.
Oh,
and they opened the doors, and they fought. So the night prior, the witnesses saw them open, and then they see them, they're shot. They opened the door and looked inside the vehicle and stuff like that. So then around 1, I think it was 1 or 1:20, a trooper gets a call that there's a car there, and he shows up. He throws some things in the car, supposedly, and calls the tow truck, and her paychecks are on the seat, so he heads to the Black Lantern Inn to see if she, you know, to talk to people about it. But the inn's closed. And he ends up leaving. He gets pulled away, and then he goes on a long weekend. So he never even files a report. So their answer to that was they just believed it was a drunk driver, which was really odd to me.
That's one of the strangest occurrences for me, because it's like, I know that this was 2004, but I worked in dispatch in around 2006, 2007. And we had the capability to call in a license plate number or check registration. And so I'm like, why did you not just immediately call in and say, hey, I've got this car. It's in this building. Let's log this. I'm going to have a tow truck come out. Like it literally would take in 30 seconds.
The car was registered to her mother, Kelly. We don't know if he followed through with that or if he never did it. But either way, he didn't utilize that information to contact the mother.
Yeah, no.
But it was an odd set of circumstances. And so if you talk to, like, the other PI that I work with is a 35-year retired police chief, 35-year law enforcement professional. And he says, look, this is really common to find cars like that. And the people show up the next day and they want their car back. They were drunk. So I think it becomes a thing where cops just, you know, they're on autopilot when it comes to that. They shouldn't be.
They should not be policed.
But my thing about it was just, it was, if that was the case, this was a really weird place for that to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I would get it if it was, the car was in a ditch or something, or, you know, something ran out in front of them, or they were drunk and they just went off the road. But this was weird. It was backed up into the house in a weird way and everything. But anyway.
How far from the road was that house? Because it didn't look like it was that far.
It's funny. It wasn't. The pictures are really deceiving. if you don't,
pictures always are.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like it's way off the road. And you know, it's funny, when I went up there early on, I remember being at the site and everything like that. And later I did a live interview and I quoted it as being way farther off the road than it actually was. But I've been up there quite a few times recently and it's just not, it's really close to the road.
Is there,
so that's strange.
Sorry. Is there like a ditch between that and the,
no,
or it's just a no, flat the, surface.
Yeah, just, yeah.
The people that live there, prior, I mean, I would imagine that's how they park. They would come up the down the road and they would just gradually pull off the road. Okay. In front of the house. Mm-hmm.
It makes me think that someone like almost, and this is just me doing my psychology stuff here, but it makes me think that almost someone came up behind her and nudged her, hit her car and nudged her off the road and then backed it into that house so that damage would be covered up.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you could plan to cover up that kind of damage if she's on the highway like that, but it looks like she pulled over in front of this house or near this house. And then whatever happened transpired there, she figured out she had to get out of there.
Yeah.
And she hit reverse. It looks like she tried to do a 3-point turn.
Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
And she hit the house because you can see her wheels turn really hard one way, which is to the driver's side. So it looks like she's backing up. Now she's got to turn it the other way and go the other way. Didn't get to do that.
Yeah. So to me, that's what it looked like. Initially, she had just pulled in like next to the house. And then maybe something transpired and she slammed on the gas and it was in reverse and she just cut it, you know what I mean? And just kept going and she ran into the house and she got the car stuck on it and couldn't go anywhere else. And I feel like somebody probably pulled her out of that vehicle.
The doors are both open, which...
Both of them, yeah, really, that's the strange part.
It's really odd, but it almost looks like... So the front seat of those cars is like a... It's like a couch.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Remember that? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It almost looks like someone opened her door to get to her. And right. She traversed the seat and fled out the other door.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which she could have easily done. She was 5'4", 100 pounds. She could have just went right across
the seat. Just bailed out, yeah.
That's what I was at her age. Yeah. I was 98 pounds, 5'3", mm-hmm. and I could... I had a family member that had a car just like that and I could scoot across the seat and get out like no time.
Yeah.
But there's also the question of the possibility of there being two people involved in taking her. The fact that there's like no blood or anything at the scene, it makes me think that they were like holding her at gunpoint or knife point or something like that, because wasn't she like, don't you say in the book that she was like a black belt or what is it that you...
She had self-defense
capabilities.
Yeah, she took some martial arts. I don't agree with a lot of people about that. I don't give that much credit.
They could have chloroformed
her. She didn't have that kind of training where she was an Olympic contender.
Right.
She was a 17-year-old girl that took some martial arts courses. Look.
And she was little.
I'm a 6'2", 220-pound guy. If a 17-year-old girl that weighs 100 pounds had a few classes under her belt, I'll break her neck.
Yeah.
You know, that's nothing. So I never really give that much credit. People disagree with me. Some people disagree with me on that. That's fine. But
I agree with you, actually.
Being
that size at that age, I completely agree with you, because I was approached, you know, at her age or a little bit older than her. And I was approached and I remember thinking, if he gets in my door, I'm done.
Yeah,
because
the man that she is referring to, our listeners know this story, but he turned out to be a serial rapist.
Really?
Yeah, and she,
the ether man.
She was like this close to being abducted by him.
Wow. Yeah. He tried to get in my door.
Yeah.
He tried.
Yeah, and so I agree with that too. I do feel like someone was following her to that location though.
Well, and you know, like at that size that night when he approached me, I knew that I was no competition for him.
Oh yeah.
And he used chloroform to render his victims unconscious. And so I knew if he gets in this door, I'm done. Mm-hmm. And so and with that mind, you can imagine what at 17, when I was only a year older than her, what she could be thinking, like, I got to get out of here because I'm not going to be able to get away from this person. Yeah.
And so there's a lot of theories on what happened there, but I think it comes down to, you know, you say in the book, those three people that stopped there, they actually took photos. They're the only ones who took photos, which blew my mind. Because, you know, it just was never processed as a crime scene. And then when they did go back, they didn't really find blood or, you know, fingerprints, whatever. And so now we're kind of just left with, well, where do we go from here? And there are so many theories that you have in this.
Yeah, book. I mean, some of them are no good. Some of them are really good. Some of them are possible, but not likely. I can tell you that, I mean, my belief is that, and I think generally, I don't want to speak for him, but the other PI that I work with, his belief also is that someone had to be watching and waiting for her to leave.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Exactly. Yeah.
No one would have known when she was leaving. She was a dishwasher. She left when she was done. No one's going to come on board that situation in that 2-minute ride. But when she leaves the inn to where her car is found, no one's just going to pull alongside her and go, hey, there's a girl that I can abduct. And jump into action. Someone was waiting for her to leave.
That's why I said that Yosemite thing. That's why I said that. Cause it just, I mean, I know it's not the same, but it just made me think of someone that knew the area, someone that, you know, had knew she, you know, obviously had seen her. And I mean, that's why I was like, Carrie's, like you said, Carrie Stainer, cause he worked there. I don't know. I'm just saying it's obviously someone that knew.
When they did start investigating it, which took a little time, you know, they start going through her past and then they start trying to connect something that had happened to her in the past to the abduction. And, you know, I think that was just a bunch of noise.
Well, and you go over in the book, you have a lot of great statistics in here, by the way.
Very accurate. With me teaching that, I was looking at those, and that's what I do is teach up to, you know, to date statistics. Yeah. I go over them with my students in college, and I was reading those, and they're very accurate and very good statistics.
I mean, you even say in here, random acts like this are exceedingly rare, which they are.
They are.
Yeah.
But people don't think they are because it's the ones they hear about the most that make national news. So they think that, oh, this is going to happen everywhere you go, when really it is a very small percentage.
You know, when I was writing it, my publisher, who's an author, and some other people that I know that have written, they all said, when you're done, if you set it aside for 6 months and then go back and read it, you're going to realize there's a lot of things that you would want to change in there. Yeah. And when you publish it, you're going to realize there's stuff that you didn't put in that you wanted to put in and stuff that you messed up. And I thought they were, I won't do that. They were right.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to wait 6 months. I mean, I didn't have that. I was going through and writing the book and going to publish it. So there are things in that section that you're talking about where I just felt like they should have been worded differently. I could give you a couple of examples, but I got the point across, I think, which was it's all interesting statistics. Statistics can be a little deceiving too, but that point about it being exceedingly rare, it is rare. And I don't think people realize it, because what's the first thing you see on television is like Nancy Grace acting like she's in a panic and mad at everybody. Standing, you know,
I know. And serial killers.
Child is missing, you
always
know.
Always a serial killer. Yeah, you know, everyone's a serial killer.
Everybody is a serial killer.
But it
killer.
Is very rare. And oddly, it is very rare. And the ones that have good endings or good outcomes leave the news cycle. So they're gone.
Oh,
you don't keep seeing
They don't care about them anymore. I mean, that sounds so bad, but
they don't.
They don't. I mean, they're on to the new exciting thing because that's their ratings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So we just had one happen here near me up by Saratoga, where a man abducted a young girl who was at Moreau State Park. She out riding her bicycle and he abducted her. I don't think they would have caught him, but he ended up coming back to the parents' house and leaving a ransom note. And they picked up a fingerprint off the note. He had been arrested for DWI like a few years prior.
Dummy.
But I don't think they would have caught him otherwise. And I think he's good for a couple other missing people up there, which was weird because when I was thinking about writing a second book, the two disappearances of girls up there, nobody ever talks about it. And I'm like, I talk to people in that area. I'm like, how do people not know that these girls are missing up here? And once in a while, you'd see something in the newspaper. I mean, obviously, law enforcement was very aware. But then when this guy got caught, they're like, one of them went missing at a trailer park he lived in at the time.
Oh, come on.
I mean, and now they're, so now they're looking at him really hard. But
you know, don't, I'm sorry, but if you're a serial killer, don't do it where you live. Most of them don't. And you know, so that's kind of not smart.
Actually, the statistics for how, where serial killers start is close to home. No, but they will stay within their safe zone, which is either around their work or around their home or something. That's where they always start, is around their safe zone. Then they get, you know, they get ballsy and they move out. But,
you know, it's interesting to me because when I think about her leaving work that night, I think about the fact that she had to have known someone was behind her.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's what I'm saying. I think they followed her from that parking lot. They sat and waited on her and followed her.
They had to. There's no other way.
There's no way around it.
Nobody came in the pitch dark, cold, warm out night and drove up alongside her and said, I'm going to take this girl. They knew they were alive. You know, the weird thing is, you're talking about, like, random abductions and stuff like that. So when the parents, Bria's parents went to the police and stuff, started that whole discussion with him over the course of days, the police told him, well, she probably just went to Boston. That's what the kids around here do. And she'll be back in a few days. And they're like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
Her car was crashed. Her paychecks were in it. Her migraine medicine's in it. Her clothing's in there. You know, no one knows where she is. Wouldn't her going to Boston entail her taking her car with her? But that, what is that phenomenon where everyone just makes excuses for stuff?
I honestly think it's just laziness.
Wouldn't you think that the first thing out of their mouth would be, we may have a missing person here.
Yeah.
Let's make excuses later. It's kind of like now that it's been 20 years when with that, I'm not talking specifically about this, but any of these investigations that are old, because it's historic, they're like, well, let's go, you know, talk to this person, that person. Well, when are we going to do that? Let's do it, you know, next month on the 18th, whatever. It seems to be like, it's so old that there's no rush. Mm-hmm. You think the opposite? Look, 20 years have gone by. Get on this shit and do it now. Let's not wait any longer because it's getting older as the days go by. That's just the wrong way of thinking. And I'll watch stuff now. And it just amazes me that the first thing out of people's mouths is to make an excuse. Mm-hmm. And you can see that with politics. You can see it with almost everything.
Well, don't make it. Now cold cases have kind of become our niche or whatever. And we do see so many of them that are like, oh, well, they're a runaway just initially straight out the gate. It's like, oh, well, they ran away. Give them a week or so and then come back and talk to us. And it's like, hello, if something did happen, we have a very small amount of time to figure that out and get our kid back or get our mom back or whatever it is.
You know, I think that's kind of that attitude's changing with law enforcement because now, you know, years ago, because there was no connectivity, the police forces would just do that.
Oh, they
now,
didn't have name us,
all
yeah.
over the news. Mm-hmm. You do that, everyone knows about it. Everyone knows you failed, you didn't do the right thing. And so now they set different protocols.
Because they're being held accountable. The second thing is drugs. It's always, the second thing is always drugs. They're either a runaway or they're into drugs and we don't care. And then cut to 20 years later and they're still missing. So
I just don't know how somebody in that position could say, well, they probably just went to Boston. Well, yeah, maybe. Probably not.
Probably not. She's 17.
How did she get there without her car?
Yeah.
Well, she probably went with a friend. Okay, so she crashed her car first and then said, let me crash my car before we go.
Hold on real quick.
Let me have no money with me. Because her paychecks are in that. Well,
it's just ridiculous.
So did they do something like what I was just talking about, put out some kind of bolo, or did they have a problem getting her on the missing list? Because I know you have to go down and register, because like with Lorene Bible in Oklahoma, they didn't have her daughter on the missing list for weeks.
It was weeks. Well, we had a case that we did like a 6-part episode coverage,
and it was on Disappeared too.
It was on Disappeared as well. It was two girls who went missing. Our friend Jax actually wrote a book about it, Hell in the Heartland. But It's kind of the same thing, because the first thing that they went to was drugs, right? And they come to this home. It's on fire. They find mom and dad dead in the home, and the two girls, 16 years old, gone. Just still vanished without trace.
Still to this day not found.
Still gone. But it's like they didn't even get put on the list as missing. That's until insane. Lorraine went down like 2 weeks later and said, I need you to put them on this list.
So I was kind of wondering if it was the same with Brianna.
No, I mean, so in the book, it kind of gives a timeline. I'm not sure I can recite it, but so her friend that she was living with, so Brianna went to work at the Lantern there on Friday night, the night she goes missing, and her friend went to stay with her sister in St. Albans, which was a little ways away. And, she comes back on Monday and sees the note hasn't moved. She saw it before she left. So she realizes it hasn't been moved. She wonders what's going on. Tuesday, she calls the Maitlands and she says, is Brianna there? Did she come home? Because she's not here. That's when alarm bells kind of go off. So they start asking around, going to friends' houses, trying to find out where she's at. They end up going to the police station. By Thursday, they go back to the police station. They're like, something's really wrong. So when they do that, the cop that was at the scene is there, and he pulls out a picture of the car, and then they know something's really wrong.
Yeah.
That's when things start to get interesting, and they start to go look for her, and the search kind of starts. But,
you have a lot of pictures in here. We like to include pictures as well. I think that really adds something to it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's more that I wanted. There was a few I couldn't get. The AP pictures I wanted, they really just made it difficult. I couldn't get anybody on the phone. It was all, you had to do it on their site, and it pissed me off to the point where I didn't do it. There was, I don't know what they would have charged me, but there was a picture of Fred Murray in the Maitlands in New Hampshire at an initial early meeting with the Vermont State Police, the New Hampshire State Police, and the FBI sat in. They were inquiring about whether the two cases were related.
Right.
That was the subject of the meeting. And just to see them in those early days and the looks on their faces, and Fred was holding a copy of The Shadow of Death. The Shadow of Death was a book written about the Connecticut River Valley Killer by an author named Philip E. Ginsberg. It's out of print now. You can find it, though. I've got a couple copies.
Put it on our list.
Yep.
when I'm like in a bookstore, I know it's out of print, so if I'm in a bookstore and I see it, I'll grab it because they're always cheap. Mm-hmm. But it's a really great book. And the serial killer was never caught. It was a series of murders right there where Maura went missing in that area, in that little valley along the Connecticut River. But the fact that here's Fred in the early days of his daughter's disappearance, and he's holding that book, which that, you know, I read a lot of true crime, and that was one book that really was frightening to me.
Yeah.
And one of the things, it was devastating to see him holding that book. And I wanted to put that picture in there, and I couldn't get it. But when I read that book, one of the things that I really could relate to in it was he described these little towns in New Hampshire and Vermont where it was almost like time forgot them. Mm-hmm. And when you go to these towns, that's kind of the way it is. I mean, they're just, it's like stepping back in time.
That there's some here in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And he described it really well. And I'm not one to criticize law enforcement. I'm not going to do it constructively, but they're just, you ever notice that when you're towns and stuff do budgets, the first thing they cut is law enforcement? That just seems like a really bad idea.
Yeah.
You know, they do the best they can. They're underpaid. They're overworked. They're understaffed.
They're getting burned.
Especially
out.
The sheriff's mm-hmm. departments.
They yeah. cover everything from directing traffic to investigating murders. I mean, it's huge. And the first thing that they do if they make a mistake is everyone jumps all over their shit. They're human. They're going to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is. And, you know, kind of in, I hope this came across good in the book too, is there was a lot of mistakes made early on in Brianna's investigation. And the police now, or for a while now, have admitted it completely, which it really was good of them to do, because you can relate to them coming out and saying, look, these mistakes were made. We're not going to try to bullshit you past it, because you can't.
Yeah.
But the people that are in there now work hard, and they you know, they get a lot of criticism now. And what I tell people, and what I said in the book was, there is a vast amount of information that you don't even know that they have. They've right. done a ton of work you're not even aware of. It, Lou Berry, the other PI, he always says, you don't know what you don't know.
Yep.
And if you know, these people are quick to criticize the police, but it, especially in Maura's case, you see it on their Facebook page a lot. They criticize the police a lot. But the fact of the matter is they've got a lot of information that you're not even aware of.
Yeah.
And you don't have the information to really make an informed opinion because mm-hmm. you can't. And they're not going to talk about it. So.
Yeah. I think we even mentioned that in our book that like, hey, this is everything we have is what we could get our hands on, but be aware that they probably have so much more that they're not giving us.
Right. And they're not going to tell you.
And they're not going to tell
you. Because we worked with the families, but I mean, they're not telling those families. We know that. They're not telling those families everything.
Information that they have. And because it's an open case, you know, there's some things that they don't want to give out. So a lot of people don't understand that.
That was one of the things that, you know, I said kind of near the end was that, you know, just be aware that they've done a ton of work that you have no idea. I was fortunate enough to know about some of it. So I can tell you that they have an overwhelming amount of information you simply don't have.
Yeah. You know,
for them to, for people to go out and bash them, you can't bash somebody if you don't have all the information.
Yeah. It's,
I'm looking at, so speaking of the pictures in here, there are two pictures in here. Now you do have some of the pictures. I mean, you have a lot of pictures, but you have some of the pictures of the car and how it was found and stuff like that. And those are very eerie photos. But to me, the most haunting photos you have, I think two in here. They're taken just a couple of days before Brianna goes missing. Yeah. Those to me are the most haunting ones. I just sit there and go, you have no idea what is about to happen.
So one of them was a popular picture, the one where she's like, it's not color in there, but she's got a red shirt on. She's looking right at the camera. And there's another one there with her and her friend, Shauna. That one right there that you're looking at, that one's never been seen publicly before. But the other ones, other ones were seen publicly, but no one really designated them as what they were. It was the night prior to she went missing. And that gives it all the meaning of that picture.
Yeah.
So, but she spent the two nights prior to going missing with that same girl, her friend, Shauna LaBelle.
Mm-hmm.
We were provided
those. It's so strange. It's just very strange. Cause like they look happy. They look like they're just kids having a good time. They have no idea.
So that goes into the other thing of, you know, everybody saying that the locals had something to do with it. The locals, a lot of them will say everybody, you know, people here know who did it. They're just not saying anything and the police know, but they can't prove it and all this other stuff. I just don't believe that at all. If it's somebody locally, it was an acquaintance who acted alone and just never told anybody. But she didn't know that this was going to take place. She was just going about her life.
Yeah.
Did they look at anyone that was staying at the inn at that time?
They did. They looked at everybody that was there. Yeah. I mean, they did pretty good with it.
They did. That's good.
Maybe could have done better, a little better, but they did look at everybody.
Okay.
Phone calls.
Tell me about, cause there's an incident in here that you talk about, where she got in a fight or she got beat up or something happened with a friend of hers a couple of days
before. I saw that on Disappeared. I did see that.
Yeah. So 22 days prior, I think it was 22 or 24 days prior, a friend of hers had left and gone to Massachusetts to visit family. And she spent time with the girl's boyfriend for a few days and 4 days. And the girl came back into town. Friends let her know. They went and got her and told her on the way back. And so her and that girl had a problem and ended up coming to a head at a party. And the girl approached her. She was sitting in a vehicle and she rolled down the window. She kept trying to talk to the girl throughout the party. And the girl wasn't having it. She's just trying to pick a fight with her. The girl went through the window, punched her twice in the face, hurt her pretty bad. And the girl went back into the party and Brianna went out, left the vehicle and started walking door to door and knocking on doors, trying to get somebody to help her. friend of hers pulled up to her, drove her somewhere to spend the night. So everyone attributed that to, that must be what it was. That must be, that girl must have done something to kill her or hurt her or whatever. We don't believe that at all.
No, that girl couldn't have overpowered her like that.
I don't think so either.
Well, there would have been a lot more to that scene if it would have been a girl that her.
The thing to keep in mind about that fight is that, again, people kind of think of them as adults when they review this case and they don't know these people, but they were 17-year-old girls, 16-17-year-old girls.
Yeah.
The girl that got in the fight with her, when you interview her, she's very open about it. She said, look, she was with my boyfriend. I would punch her again for that. She was with
my boyfriend. I beat her ass.
Yeah. And she's like, I'd do it again. And then that girl got in some pretty relatively serious trouble twice. And, you know, the police, of course, take that opportunity to sit down with her and say, you know, if you know anything about this, it would benefit you greatly because you're in deep shit. And she said, look, I would have told you a long time ago if I knew anything. She doesn't hide anything. She'll talk to us anytime we want. She never backs away from any topics. She'll talk with us freely. She had nothing to do with this.
Yeah, I just don't. I don't think it was either. It was someone that could way overpower her.
Yeah, I think. I really do think someone just was waiting for her in that parking lot. I don't even know if they knew her, but I think they had seen her a couple times.
Oh, they had to have seen her before.
And just decided.
So somebody knew to wait for her. They knew what her car looked like. They knew that she was working there, and they knew to wait for her there. Yeah. Because that's the only way they got on board with this. And it would have been easy to do because it's like right on the edge of town, and it's like a neighborhood, and there's a little church kind of kitty corner and stuff. They could have waited for her to leave. For sure.
It almost makes me believe that, like, they could have been, like, stalking her for a minute and knew not to abduct her at her house where she was staying because she was staying with another girl, and that there would be people coming in and out of there all the time. It'd be easier.
But again, when, you know, I was approached, he was sitting over in a Love's parking lot waiting for somebody. And he watched me at the payphone, I'm sure, for quite a while. Because I was on the payphone in my car. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure he watched me and my friend in the car with me for quite a while. It was a girl not any bigger than me. Mm-hmm. And before he made his way over. So whoever was watching her probably watched her for a couple nights, I'm guessing.
I'm just saying. Like, that's what makes the most sense to
me. Well, I worked right there next to the Loves. I worked at the next... the Southern Athletic, which was a gym. And so I would come out. That was my work schedule. I'd come out and get in my car at night. So he could have been...
Well, see, how do you know that he wasn't watching you?
Well, that's what I mean. He could have been watching me for the last couple days.
That's
so
creepy, man.
It makes me wonder if maybe they weren't doing that with Brianna.
They never asked him? Yeah. They never asked him if he was watching you?
There
are so many victims.
There's 365.
What?
There were so many victims. He would hit up basically college towns amongst tons of different states.
Oh, Colorado, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Texas.
Yeah, there was a ton of victims.
He tried to blow up a police officer's home.
Yeah, it was.
With a bomb.
It's crazy.
That's insane.
Yeah, he was called the Ether Man. That's what they called him because he used chloroform and ether a lot.
That's insane. I'm going to have to look this up.
He wore a trench coat, and he was tall. It's creepy, like, extremely tall.
You think
tall.
That would be a dead giveaway, wearing a trench coat?
I know.
I think so.
But he had a car that looked like Brianna's.
Yeah, oh.
I remember that. He did have a car like that at the time.
So creepy.
It looked like what?
He
looked like Brianna's car.
It was Brianna. Oh, it looked just like her car. It was brown, but he had a... And when the police at the time did not really care. They just were like, oh, he didn't get you. Okay, bye-bye.
Well, she was smart, okay? She took off. When she took off...
He followed me.
He followed her, and she actually drove straight to the police department. And he...
Oh, wow.
I pulled in.
Yeah, like, pulled in and sat there. And
to where their gates were. And they didn't have gates at the time, so you could just drive back in the parking lot. And they have gates now there. And I just drove back in there. And he actually, once I got in there, he drove off at like 100 miles an hour. But it was like 10 years later when they caught him. Mm-hmm. And I knew exactly the moment I saw him that was him. Because I remembered what he looked like to a T. And so,
hundreds of victims.
Oh, hundreds. So basically, I talked to the investigator at that time, and they're like, yeah, okay.
We've like, got enough to put him away for a while. We don't need
they
you.
They didn't really care because he didn't get me.
Wow.
Yeah, it's wild.
What a story. Holy cow.
Yeah, they didn't care. They're like, yeah, we've got lots of people.
But see, this is the stuff we wanted to put in our first book, and we kept hearing, no, don't put stuff about yourself. So we're putting stuff in the second one.
Yeah, and so, but that instance being her age, it just makes me, like, I had no idea he was sitting there. I had no idea that he was over at the Loves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
No idea, because there were some... I mean, well, number one, I was young.
Yeah, and so, you're young and you don't really pay attention to stuff like that.
So that's why I tell everyone, watch your surroundings. Mm-hmm. If you see a car sitting over in another parking lot, if you see something when you leave, don't leave. Don't yeah. leave.
Right.
That's wild. But yeah, this is, it's a really great book. It's really well written. I have a bunch of highlights in here that of even quotes that you have in here, just that I love. I really love nice. That little section where you talked about the innocent and proven innocent until proven guilty part that you put in there. I loved that.
You know what? I get so frustrated with people not understanding that.
Yeah. I love that.
I really do. That's why I put it in there. I'm like, people don't understand this concept.
I loved it so much. And even this one line that I highlighted, you are not obligated to stand by the concept that protects legal defendants. Fear and safety should guide your decision. And you have like, well, he's innocent until proven guilty. And then, okay, well, your burden of proof is not the same as that of the judicial system.
Right.
Like, would
right.
you, would you still, like, if he's molesting children, are you going to let your kid go and stay the night? Yeah. Of course not.
I always tell my friends, like I've discussed it with different people. If I hear someone say somebody's innocent until proven guilty, I automatically know they don't understand that, or they're an idiot, one or the other, because the only place it's applicable is in a courtroom. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Not something that you apply outside of a courtroom. You just don't. Right. It doesn't apply. There's no. And if you read the book, you'll understand why. But yeah. So whenever anybody says it, I go, eh, here we go. I'm going to have to get in an argument and explain this to somebody. You know,
I have to. So we have to, like, legally, we have like an advisement or whatever, you know, at the front of our episode when we talk about yeah. cases and stuff, we literally have to, we have to say that, right? Because yeah. it's legal, right? That's us covering our butts.
We have
right?
a, right. we have counsel that but, has told us we have to do that.
Yeah. But when really? It comes to, like, for instance, when I moved into this house that we live in now, in our neighborhood, we had a pedophile living a couple doors down, and I didn't know that. It hadn't occurred to me to check that. And now I have a kid, and I'm like talking to the yeah. neighbors about it. And they're like, well, you know, he did his time, and, you know, yeah, he, yeah he's make a registered. Excuses. And I'm like, okay, but I'm not going to let my kid play in front of his house.
That's why do people do that? That's an example. You're making excuses for people. Don't I make know. Excuses. He did what he did.
Don't make excuses.
And it's, if you look into it, people that have that problem, they can't resolve it. It's with them for the rest of their life. You can't go and get, doesn't matter how much incarceration you go through or therapy you go through.
Right.
It's the predilection you're going to have. So
there yeah. are some things that cannot be reformed. I feel like
yeah.
that's yeah. my opinion.
Oh no.
But
if you're a psychopath, you cannot be reformed.
That, you know, I don't care that my neighbor across the street had like secondary burglary charges. I don't care about that, because that was 15 right. years ago. And yeah, that's probably long behind him. But yep. the guy down the street who was literally making and selling and distributing child pornography. Yeah, I'm sorry, just, but
you make it sound like you live.
I live in a horrible neighborhood. No, I'm just kidding.
Not.
It's a really nice neighborhood.
It does sound like well, that the way you're talking.
I mean, Mandy, through your education, you must know that obviously that's a thing, right? This isn't resolvable issue.
Oh, no.
You can't. Yeah, it's with them for their life.
You know, I'm kind of like, if you do something at 16, you know, and you do some drugs, and yes, you can be rehabilitated. But again, we're talking, what kind of drugs? Were you into meth? What were you into? Yeah. You know, if you can relapse, you know, anytime in your life. So there's still that what ifs, even if you can be reformed.
Yeah.
Now, do I think they should have somebody in prison for 20 years that sold a little bit of marijuana? No. I think we're putting people in the wrong place. Now, do I think you should for fentanyl?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because that kills people. Right. But I also think that they are focusing on... I don't know how to be nice because I teach these people.
When it comes to a sexual crime.
When it comes to a sexual crime, you cannot be reformed. No.
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 It's not going to happen.
No. It doesn't matter. You can go to all the therapy in the world and it doesn't matter. It is in your DNA.
Yeah.
You were born that way.
And a lot of people, we've talked about this before, a lot of people who go on to commit this sexual deviance was also probably a victim in their younger years.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen that a lot. But I've also seen some that have used that as an excuse.
Yeah. Yes, and that's a thing too, where, like, I'm not in any way saying that's an excuse.
No, but I mean, a lot of them have been. But, you know, there's always something. They're always like, well, my parents were not around. Yeah. You know, I raised myself.
Well, I had a real shit childhood, but I'm not killing people. I'm not.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think it's ingrained. It's ingrained in who you are, because just like everyone's had something in their life, but that doesn't mean they go out and rape and kill people.
Right.
I think that, you know, there's some empathy part of your brain in the prefrontal cortex that is just not working.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yes, I completely agree with you. I think sexual violence is just not.
No.
It just is what it is.
Yeah. Which to me is why, because I'm a sexual assault survivor when I was 16. To me, I feel like there should be no statute of limitations on sexual crimes. I just feel like there isn't. If you can't be reformed, you're always going to be that way. There's going to be more victims. Like, right. That's just my opinion.
I don't understand the whole statute of limitations thing anyway.
I don't know what happened to Brianna, but I do feel like that it was probably sexually motivated.
Sexual motivation doesn't have to be actual sexual.
Right.
It can be
right.
just violent, and that's right. how they get their sexual control. Gratification. Right. Yeah, it's control. Yeah. And so
control.
I don't know that it was... I just don't know, but I definitely think someone watched her, and I definitely think someone...
I think, yeah, they were stalking her for sure.
They had a fixation on her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, what have you ever, I know you've probably looked into this, but has anyone ever, like, very close to that town or in that town gone missing since Brianna? So it's almost like an isolated incident. Well, not
that wasn't resolvable. It happens, but they're resolvable. There are other issues, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it I could say drifter, but a grifter?
A grifter. What's grifter. A grifter?
There's a difference.
It seems like you just made that up.
No, there is a difference. A drifter is like a gypsy.
Oh.
And a grifter is someone that actually stays for a little. Isn't that right? Stays for short periods of time and then moves on.
Grifters are kind of con people.
Yeah.
They stay
and do their business and then they move on.
Oh.
There actually is a disappearance up in Canada that's semi-close that's... It's interesting that you don't hear mentioned a lot, named Melina Martin, who was 13 years old. So that's one that's kind of interesting that's nearby. And the other that's really interesting is Mora.
I'm sure that they've checked that pond.
Yeah. Oh, that's all that it's all been searched thoroughly. There's nothing there. Whatever took place and she's gone from there.
They took her from that.
As opposed to Brianna's situation that we talked about, Mora's situation, she lives alone in a dorm. She's going to school. She contacts her instructors and fabricates a story about a death in the family. She leaves at an unpredictable time to an unpredictable destination. She stops and she buys alcohol. She's driving a vehicle that her father told her under no circumstances do you drive this vehicle. There's something wrong with it. It was running less a cylinder. It was smoking really bad. He had actually been there to try to buy her a vehicle. They were looking at vehicles. But she leaves and she drives 150 miles north up into this remote area, gets onto this weird side road and slides off the road. And a man and a bus driver pulls up to her, school bus driver, and asked her if she's okay. And she says, yeah. And he says, you want me to call the police? She says, no, I already called the tow truck or something like that. And
AAA.
Yeah. AAA. And he goes up into his driveway, backs in, and goes to the house. Tells his girlfriend and his mother, hey, call this in. There's an accident. And within, you know, he sits out in the truck and on his logbook, and he's watching cars go by and stuff like that. And the police show up and she's gone. So she left at an unpredictable time, went to an unpredictable destination and had an unpredictable accident, as opposed to Brianna, where she was fairly well monitored, mm-hmm. and she was functioning around people she knew and stuff like that. This is where I kind of get myself in trouble publicly. So, you know, the question has always been, do you think these two things are related? So in the beginning, when I spoke about that picture I was talking about of the Maitlands and Fred Murray at a meeting, outside of a meeting, what happened was initially there in the beginning, after the two disappearances, the Vermont State Police went to New Hampshire. They had a meeting. Are these things related? The FBI sat in. They came out and publicly they said, we do not believe these two things are related. There's no serial killer on the loose. And they made that statement a couple of times early on, and then they just never commented on it again or whatever, for obvious reasons, because it's not something they can prove and it gets them into trouble. But anyway, I'm the only one that comes forward and says, I think you should entertain the idea that they're related. And everybody stomps their feet and yells, you don't have the evidence. You can't prove that. Dude, I get that. Okay. Dude, I understand that. But there's a reason I say that you should entertain the idea that they're related. And that reason is that when they looked at these two cases, if you held out your hand and said, Brianna in this hand, and Morris case in this hand, these circumstances are different. Yes?
Yeah.
They're very different. So they come out and they go, we don't think these are, based on this information, we don't think that these two are related. That doesn't make any sense. That's like falling for a logical fallacy, mm-hmm. because a stranger abduction or a stranger type acquaintance abduction doesn't give a shit what your lifestyle is,
no.
who you live with, where you're no. going, mm-hmm. where you are. All he cares about is the situation conducive to what I want to do at this moment?
Is it opportunistic?
Can I pull it off?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So in Brianna's case, when you read the book, her friend talks about a man that came and met her briefly and liked her. So, and I won't spoil it. You can read it for yourself. It goes into more detail. I think this person was a predator. And in the book, there's a section on predators. And in that section on predators, well, in the book, there's discussion of somebody that's, you know, viable. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's worth entertaining that they're related. There's no reason not to.
Yeah.
There's really no justifiable reason to say I'm not going to entertain this. You know, I got involved in a conversation online with a guy who, you know, obviously had studied critical thinking because he was using the jargon and stuff like that. But he
I teach that. I actually start a class this next week. I'm teaching critical thinking.
They used to teach that in every school, by the way, in every high school. But you could tell that he'd studied it because he was using the jargon, overusing the jargon. But he absolutely insisted every time you mentioned, well, I think you would find this interesting, this particular facet of this theory, he'd say, you don't have the evidence. You can't prove that they're related. I get that. But he wouldn't stop with that. Okay. So we just can't discuss it then? It's not open. It's not an open. You know, we don't know what happened. You would think you'd want to entertain that idea based on A, B, C, D, and E. Now, I can go into it pretty deeply, but I can't do it publicly. Yeah. So, and everybody, and that's a problem with doing podcasts and interviews and stuff, because people, when you get to the point where you say there's stuff I can't talk about publicly, they go, oh, boy, that's stupid. You know,
that's no fun.
Don't tell us if you're not going to tell us the stuff. Well, there's stuff I can't talk about publicly. I'm
people
sorry.
Will ask us because we're not just podcasters, we're authors, and people ask us and we're like, we can't
actually investigate. Yeah. You know, these
we can't
cases,
talk about so. That publicly.
So, I mean, I've had stuff shared with me that just I can't make public, but there is stuff that publicly you can say, and there's absolutely every reason to at least entertain it, at least leave it on the table.
Yeah,
maybe it was him.
And I think that, you know, when you read that stuff in the book, it kind of and like jab that a little bit.
I would have, you should have said to him, well, is it because it's you?
Yeah.
Let's critically think that.
Yeah.
Where were you at this time and this day?
Where were you at, sir? Well, let's tell my listeners where they can find your book.
So it's sold through my publisher. So if you Google the title, The Hunt for Brianna Maitland, it will come up. Boom. And if you go on there on that site and you want to look at the stores, there's a, it'll say see stores. You can hit that and it'll tell you where, what stores it's available in. And, or you can reach out to me on Facebook and I'll sign your copy and send it to you. I accept credit card, debit card, PayPal. It's, Greg Overacker, and I have a private page, but it's got a little Black Sabbath angel devil. No, it's me. There's not a ton of us. There's a few Greg Orangers, but not a ton. Yeah. And it's gotten great reviews and I'm real happy with that. And that people said it was written respectfully and I'm happy about that too.
It was, it really was.
Glad, and I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to lend it to Mandy and she can't.
I know.
Don't do anything. It's signed, Mandy.
I know. I need to reach out to you and get one. I know.
I'll send you.
I need to.
I'll send you one.
Oh, yay. I would be so excited.
Thank you so much for hanging out and talking with us. I know. I think I initially told you it was going to be like 30 minutes.
That's okay.
But you know what? This is what happens when we start talking shop and we start getting into.
I wrote the book that I would want to read. When I buy a book about something, I don't want to have to read four books to get all the information.
Right.
This book will give you all the facts.
Yeah.
It'll give you everything.
It really does. It breaks it down really well, I think.
Oh, well.
I endorse this book. Yeah. And he does have a several other cases that they looked into some stuff about more in there and a bunch of suspects and theories that they went over and a bunch of stuff. It's all in there and it's really great.
Yeah. I really check this book out, please.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Raven's Reviews. Catch more next time on the Sirens Podcast.